know what he had in mind. His, the title of the conference was Optimal Transportation and Nonlinear Dynamics or something like that. And my connection with those topics is somewhat accidental. I really work on nonlinear equations, so nonlinear partial differential equations and applications to geometry and things like that. So in the end, Wilfred said, it should be PDE and it should be interesting. So I'll try to satisfy at least one of those. Okay, so so that's the title. Maybe can I use both? So that's the title. So Hessian equations are, the Hessian equations I will talk about. Mainly the K Hessian. So we take the kth order elementary symmetric function of the eigenvalues of the Hessian. So if you take the sum of the eigenvalues, you get the Laplace operator. If you take the product of the eigenvalues, you get the Monge-Ampère operator. And as Robert mentioned, the Monge-Ampère equation has a close connection with optimal transport. Some of the geometric inequalities that Robert talked about, and he did mention in particular that some of these inequalities require something more general than a Monge-Ampère equation. Well, there's some sort of Hessian equations, in fact, that come into it. So some of the things I'll talk about may eventually prove to be useful for studying some of those problems, but I'm not going to get onto any of that today. So they're the equations I want to talk about. In probably the second or third lecture, I'll also come to something more general where you replace the eigenvalues by the principal curvatures of a hypersurface and you get the corresponding curvature equations. So anyway, one thing we know about these equations, in particular you know that from the Monge-Ampère equation, the Monge-Ampère equation is elliptic on convex solutions, or degenerate elliptic on convex solutions. It's not elliptic in general. It can change type. So generally, if you want to use elliptic theory, you have to be in a setting where convex solutions are what you are looking for. On the other hand, at the other extreme, you've got the Laplace equation, and that's elliptic on everything, of course. And in between, you have, as k gets closer to the n, to n, the set where the equation is elliptic gets smaller. As k goes down towards 1, it gets larger. So the set of functions on which we normally study these equations, well, it's a cone in Rn defined in this way. So for a given integer k, the sj's should be positive or non-negative on for each j up to from 1 up to k. So the eigenvalues at each of a function at each point should belong to this cone. And often we want the strict inequality here, rather, and that, in that case I'll call them uniformly k-convex. Some people call them strictly k-convex. So usually it'll be uniformly k-convex. So on this, if the eigenvalues belong to this cone at each point, we have an elliptic equation. And if it's elliptic, we have some hope of dealing with it. If it's not elliptic, it becomes a much more difficult problem to deal with. So first, let me, yes?
So is that just a question to relate these notions? So in the theory of minimal surfaces, sometimes there is also some notion of convexity, which is not somewhere in between a condition on the mean curvature and full convexity. Is that related to these conditions of convexity?
Do you mean when they say mean convex, so usually that means positive mean curvature or non-negative mean curvature. Well, it is related. I mean, one convex means subharmonic, two convex is a little stronger, and so on. N convex is convex in the usual sense. If you want to talk about the curvatures, you really should replace the eigenvalues here by the principal curvatures, and that gives you notions of convexity for hypersurfaces. So what they call mean convex in that case would be positive mean curvature, non-negative mean curvature. Okay, so the first thing is there's a notion of weak solution, which is the viscosity solution, and I imagine most people have seen that idea before. So basically, if the solution is continuous but no better than continuous, you can't talk about its first derivatives or second derivatives, so you can't really make sense of the equation in the classical sense. So to do something with these weak solutions, the idea is that you transfer the differential equation or the differential inequality onto a comparison function. So if we have a k-convex function phi, which is in C2, and u minus phi has a local maximum at a point x0, then we say u is a viscosity solution of equation 1 over there. If for every point in x0 in omega, every k-convex function phi of class C2, such that u minus phi has a local maximum, you have fk of phi at x0 is bigger than or equal to psi at x0. So if I draw a picture on the blackboard, there's not much room, but so here's u. We take a function phi which touches somewhere. Okay, and then if this was a classical solution, you would have d phi at x0 equal to du at x0, and d2 phi at x0 would be bigger than or equal to d2 u at x0. So if you had a classical solution, you would have that, and then the ellipticity gives you this. Or the other way around, actually. Okay, so you get the notion of viscosity solution simply by dropping that. And if the function phi touches from below, the inequality goes the other way. And if it's true for functions which touch from above and functions which touch from below, then we say it's a viscosity solution. Okay, and the viscosity notion is quite good. You have comparison principles, so you get uniqueness, say, for the Dirichlet problem under reasonable conditions. You have a good existence theory. But there is this restriction that it is good for continuous functions. If you want to go, sometimes you want to go to things which are not continuous to enlarge the class, and then viscosity is not such a good notion anymore. For these K Hessian equations, there's a measure theoretic notion of solution. So first of all, if you deal with the class of upper semi-continuous functions on a domain omega, then we say it's U is K convex if it's FKU is bigger than or equal to zero in omega in the viscosity sense, so in the sense I described here. And this makes sense basically because you can talk about, if you look at U minus phi, that's upper semi-continuous, so you can talk about the behavior as you go to a point x0, you can talk about lim sup as you go to x0. So you can define this notion in the viscosity sense. So we have a notion of K convex, and then so we can talk about K convex functions for upper semi-continuous. Now, if you now smooth the function, you use a regularization like this, so eta is some function which is smooth, has compact support in the unit ball, say. Usually it's symmetric. Then when you smooth that, you get U is at least L1, locally L1 for this. You get a smooth function, U epsilon. It's called the mollification or the regularization. That's a smooth function. So you can talk about the K convexity in this classical sense. And it turns out that the U epsilons are, if you have U K convex in this viscosity sense, then the U epsilons, at least if you shrink down to a slightly smaller domain, they are K convex in the classical sense. And furthermore, as epsilon decreases, the U epsilons converge down to U. And these functions FK of U epsilon, they converge, not as functions necessarily, but as measures, so in a weak measure sense. So if you integrate against a function with compact support, then the limit object exists in the class of measures. And that's called the K Hessian measure of U. Okay, so here are some examples. If WK is given by each of these, depending on the value of K, these are all K convex for the appropriate K. And FK of WK is zero except at Y. In fact, to be more precise, F of KWK is the delta function at Y, and there's some appropriate constant that goes in the front depending on K and N. Okay, so that's a more precise statement. So these are the so-called fundamental solutions for these equations. So you see In the Monge-Ampère case, you just get mod x minus y, a cone. When k is 1, you get the usual fundamental solution of the Laplacian, or it comes with a minus sign in this case. So possibly there's a... Yeah, it's got a minus sign. And in between, you've got the logarithm. Okay, so the main topic is the regularity for these sorts of equations. So first of all, you get some regularity for free, basically, from k convexity. And that's what the first statement says. If you're in the range where k is bigger than n over 2, then you're automatically in the class of continuous functions. In fact, held a continuous, and you get that exponent alpha equals 2 minus n over k. And you see that's a sharp exponent, because that's this case here. So some regularity you get just by being in the class of k-convex functions. If k is below that, you don't get any continuity, as these examples show. On the other hand, if you have a right-hand side of the equation, which is not just a measure, like here, but something reasonable, like a function, an LP function, then there's a p which depends on n and k. If p is bigger than n over 2k, and psi is in LP, non-negative, and we have a k-convex weak solution of the equation, then you get some Hölder continuity for any alpha less than 1, which is also less than this number. So as p gets large, you get C0 alpha for all alpha less than 1. Yes? I'm sorry? It could be the weak in viscosity sense, or it could be weak in the measure theoretic sense. It doesn't matter. It's true for both. Okay, so if the right-hand side is in a nice enough space, you get some extra continuity. And then we can go a little bit further. If the right-hand side is... And now I take the kth root. If the right-hand side is Lipschitz and non-negative, then the solution is locally Lipschitz. And that's as far as you can go. You don't get any more regularity beyond that unless you make more assumptions on the solution. There are solutions which are Lipschitz but not C1, and the right hand side is a smooth positive function, constant, if you like, 1. And that's true for k bigger than or equal to 3. So that's as far as you can go with the regularity without further assumptions. And the examples look like this. So the first one's an example of Pogorelov. It goes back to early 1970s, I think, so it's around 30 years old. This is in k variables, Rk. This function here is a viscosity solution of the Monge-Ampère equation in a small ball in Rk. And on the right-hand side, you've got something, it's a polynomial. And on a small ball, it's positive, so you've got a smooth positive function. But the solution is only C1 alpha, and alpha is 1 minus 2 over k. Okay, so you see what's happening. on this small ball, if I draw sort of a picture, you've got a line segment where the solution is not smooth. So the graph contains a line segment, so when x1 up to xk minus 1 is 0, all 0, you have this line segment, and the solution fails to be strictly convex there. So you've got, along the line segment, you've got 0 second derivatives, and coming in towards it in orthogonal directions, the second derivatives are blowing up. And there's some sort of cancellation taking place so that determinant of the Hessian remains smooth and positive. Okay. So that puts a limitation on the regularity theory. Caffarelli has modified this example. So again, it looks like this, and this time, because you're taking basically mod x prime, where x prime means the first k minus 1 components, you get something that's only Lipschitz. And if you do the computation, you find again that you get a smooth or reasonable right-hand side in a small ball. In fact, if k is 4, you get something as positive and smooth as you like, analytic. But the solution is only Lipschitz. It's not even C1. So again, you've got the same sort of picture here. You've got some sort of degeneracy along a line segment, and the second things sort of becoming flat in one direction, and in the other directions the second derivatives blow up. But it happens in such a way that things cancel, and the determinant of the Hessian stays nice and positive, smooth, positive. So this second example shows you that that is sort of optimal. Okay. And you get examples for the K Hessian equations. Well, I've set this up so that it's in RK, but if you now extend the function to be constant in K plus 1 up to N directions, then you get a solution of the K Hessian equation that has the same properties. So this is sort of optimal. So that so that sort of limits what we can hope to prove. Now, so as I explained here, what happens in these examples, you've got the singularity along a line segment which runs out to the boundary. So what's going on here is the solution is not smooth at the boundary of the ball. And the normally elliptic equation has some sort of regularization effect. That doesn't work here because, it just doesn't. What you need to overcome that is either smoothness of the solution on the boundary or some other condition. So there's this theorem of Caffarelli, Nirenberg, and Sprach, and various other people also have proved it and made contributions to the theory of Hessian equations. I'm sure there's quite a few names I haven't mentioned here. So if you have a bounded domain, C4 boundary, and it's uniformly the boundary is uniformly k minus 1 convex. So that means I take the vector I get of the principal curvatures of the boundary, and I look at the corresponding cones in Rn minus 1, it should belong to the cone gamma k minus 1. So I defined them a while back. Yes? Yes, yes. Another way is to say that it's the level set of a K convex function. Strictly K convex, or uniformly K convex. And you have C4 boundary data, C4. Then for a reasonable sort of right-hand side, C2 positive, you can solve the Dirichlet problem. It has a unique smooth solution, smooth up to the boundary. And that's true not just for K-Hessian equations, but for more general Hessian equations. You can make sort of general structure conditions if you want. So here you've got smooth boundary data, or you can go in another direction and look at less smooth boundary data, but rather special. So again, the boundary is C2. You don't really need C2 here, just it's enough that it's the you can weaken that. But the key thing is zero boundary values. Or affine boundary values, if you like, constant. Then you get a solution which is smooth in the interior and Lipschitz up to the boundary. That's theorem was first proved by Cho and Wang. It was published in 2001, but I think preprint was around quite some time before that, a couple of years at least. So the examples I had before, they don't satisfy any of those conditions, right? You don't have a smoothness on the boundary, you don't have zero boundary value, right? So if you get away from those, you need either smooth boundary data or special sort of boundary conditions. So some of the questions that you can ask now is, well, first problem one is how smooth. If you forget about what happens at the boundary, what do you need to prove interior regularity? And you know, well, you've got some classical theory. If you know the solution is already C2 alpha, you can just plug into the Schauder theory and get higher regularity. If you know the solution is C2, you can't plug into the Schauder theory. You need something else before you can do that. That's the LP theory. So basically, you apply these to the once differentiated equation. It's not quite legal to differentiate the equation once, so you do it with a difference quotient argument, and you get a sort of a linear equation with the right sort of coefficients, so you can plug in to these theories. If you start with something which is not C2 but just C11, it's still uniformly elliptic if the right hand side is positive, and you can plug into the Evans-Krylov estimates to get C2 alpha. So you apply that basically to second order difference quotients. Okay? And these things are true. This is the first two are true not just for Hessian equations but for general fully nonlinear elliptic equations. The last one requires a concavity condition, which is satisfied for these K Hessians. Okay, but otherwise you don't need anything else except uniform ellipticity. And then when you get down to more specific equations, so the K Hessian equations, things change. If you want to go below that, you really need to look at the structure of the equation much more carefully. And so here are some results. If you start with a W2P solution and P is bigger than N times N minus 1, then you can get higher regularity for the Monge-Ampere equation. And that's a result of Trudinger about 20 years ago. And the proof uses the Alexandrov-Bakelmann maximum principle. Then sometime after that I proved that this is not really the right exponent here, but half of that is enough to get regularity, higher regularity. And a little bit later, well, I did it at the same time, Caffarelli sort of redid it in a different way. If you have C1 alpha, then an alpha is big enough, then you get higher regularity. And these exponents here, for the Monge-Ampère equation, they're sharp. The Pogorelov example shows you that. This example here, if you do the computation, you see they're sharp. In fact, here, you could allow greater than or equal to. The Pogorelov example is in W2P for all P less than this number. Okay, so they're the sharp results for the Monge-Ampère equation. The proof of these ones goes sort of differently. What's involved here is proving that the solution is strictly convex. So you show that if you have the graph, the solution, then at each point, you can look at the tangent plane, and it touches at one point only. It's strictly convex in that sense. It touches at one point only. Yes?
Can these exponents be motivated by some embedding for traces or so? Or is there no...
The exponents come... Well, you'll see where they come from in a little bit. They come from... The K comes from the K Hessian. Well, I haven't talked about that. The N, basically, they come from a Sobolev inequality. At least in the W2P case, they come from a Sobolev inequality. Okay, so in these last two, it's really a proof is, it's a strict convexity proof. And what it's saying is, you see, if it's controlled in W2P, you have some control on how fast derivatives are blowing up, and so if you turn that around in an appropriate way, it's telling you if they're not blowing up too fast, then in other directions they can't be going to zero too fast, and so you get a sort of a strict convexity estimate out of that. That works fine for the Monge-Ampère equation, but it doesn't really work for K-Hessian equations, in fact, at least not in any way that I've been able to make sense of.
The middle one just, I mean, if you want the determinant to be locally on one, sounds like that's what you require for the middle one.
For this? Oh, I'm assuming the right-hand side here, you have a reasonable right-hand side, say, bounded away from zero, or bounded between two. Actually, for these, to get the strict convexity here, all you need is bounded away from zero. But to get the regularity, then you need some f which is nice, bounded between two positive constants and one or two derivatives. Okay, so that's problem one. The problem one is to figure out what do you need before the regularity theory starts to work. And as I mentioned, Pogorelov's example shows those exponents are sharp. Problem two is forget about weak solutions. If you just look at smooth solutions, what estimates can you prove? And why might you want to do that? Well, very often, if you want to prove something for weak solutions, it's technically much more complicated because you may have to make an approximation, you may not be able to differentiate the equation, you have to use difference quotients and regularization and so on. So to avoid those technicalities, if you can at least understand how to do the estimates for smooth solutions, then maybe you can go and work on the generalized solutions. Okay, you can ask the same questions for curvature equations, where you replace the eigenvalues by principal curvatures. And you see, Laplacian goes to the mean curvature operator, you see that's quite a lot more complicated. The determinant of the Hessian goes to this Gauss curvature operator, and that is not such a big jump in complexity because the gradient part separates out quite nicely. But in all the intermediate stuff, the gradient and the second derivatives are tangled up in a very complicated way. In fact, you almost never see them written out explicitly because it's just too, it doesn't tell you anything, it's too messy. So that's problem three. Then problem four is, as I mentioned, you can prove some estimates if you have a nice boundary condition, u equals zero on the boundary, for example. So what sort of estimates can you prove with that boundary condition? And then if you want to, you can go not just to K-Hessian and K-curvature equations, but to more general Hessian and curvature equations. So there, some of the things I will talk about. I'll see how far I get. Okay, so let's start with the regularity for the K-Hessian equation. So this is the theorem. Suppose you have a W2P weak solution of the equation, and the right-hand side is reasonably nice. It's positive, and say C11. Then the theorem is that if P is large enough, if it's bigger than K times N minus 1 over 2, then you can bound the second derivatives locally, and then you can plug into the Evans-Krylov estimates and get C2 alpha, and then it plugs into the uniformly elliptic machinery, and you can get more if G is smoother. Okay, so this theorem is, as I already said, it's essentially optimal for the Monge-Ampere case. And we don't know if it's optimal for K-Hessian, because the Pogorelov example gives you, if you work it out, it gives you this lower bound. P has to be bigger than or equal than K times K minus 1 over 2. And here we've got K times N minus 1. So for the K-Hessian equations, we don't know yet what the optimal exponent is. My feeling is that this is the optimal exponent. But I don't know that. This exponent, it's basically the Pogorelov's counterexample for the Monge-Ampere equation, and then you just extend it to be constant in all the other directions. So if you want to show that this is optimal, you really need something, a counterexample which is more sophisticated than Pogorelov's. I don't know how to build that. So my feeling is that this is the optimal exponent. Possibly, maybe you can allow greater than or equal to. That's sort of the borderline case is unclear for K-Hessian. Although it is clear for the Monge-Ampere equation. If K is equal to 2, that case is rather special. If K and N are both 2, you've got the two-dimensional Monge-Ampere equation. In that case, you don't have any of these counterexamples. You get smooth solutions, so there's no restriction on P if K is 2. And if K is equal to N, equal to 2. If K is 2 and N is bigger than or equal to 3, we don't have any counterexamples to regularity. So the conjecture is that you shouldn't need a condition, but so far no one has managed to prove that. That's quite a difficult problem, I think. OK, Okay, so so I've got another 15 minutes or so. Yes?
You don't need conditions, so which means that you just assume that U is in W2P for some P and G is in
Well.
So what kind of result do you expect?
For here, I expect that any weak solution with a reasonable right-hand side should be have appropriate smoothness.
And the right-hand side should be...
positive and, say, smooth, and the solution should be smooth. But we don't know. Okay, so so how does the proof of coming back to the question that Ott Felix raised, the n comes from the Sobolev inequality, the k comes from the equation, and you'll see shortly how that comes about. So the structure you've got here for the K-Hessian equations, well, the ellipticity looks like this. If you work out Fij, it's just a matrix. You take the derivative with respect to the second derivative, and it gives you a matrix. If you're in this class of admissible solutions, the eigenvalues belong to this cone gamma k, then the minimum eigenvalue is bounded from below by 1 over Laplacian up to a constant. The maximum eigenvalue is bounded by the k minus first elementary symmetric function. So the trace, if you take this up to a constant, it's fk minus 1. And so the ellipticity ratio, the ratio of the maximum eigenvalue of the minimum, it's like Laplacian times fk minus 1, or if you use the sort of the arithmetic geometric mean inequality, the appropriate version of it here, that's bounded by roughly up to a constant Laplacian to the k. But sometimes this going to here is throwing away too much information. Sometimes you have to keep the fk if you want to get... the other property we need is concavity. So if we take the kth root of fk, then that's concave as a function of the second derivatives. And the last property is that the Fij matrix is divergence free. So here it's a sum over I. Okay, so this is something you can work out. It boils down to the fact that if you do the computation somewhere, you've got a symmetric, you've got an anti-symmetric matrix, and then you've got something symmetric because the partial derivatives commute. You take what I mean is something like, you take di ukl, and this all is symmetric in everything. When you do the computation, you find somewhere you've got something anti-symmetric and something symmetric, and so when you take the trace, you get zero. And you can work it out in two dimensions very simply. Okay, so they're the structure conditions. And now, let's just look at the right-hand side as constant 1. That simplifies things a bit. You take the kth root, and then you differentiate twice. And as I said, G is concave. So this term, that you get here, you simply throw it away using concavity. You don't need that term. You get rid of it. And you get a differential inequality like this. And then you can go back and rewrite it. Instead of Gijs, you can put back the Fijs. So I wrote it in this form to use the concavity, but then I want to put the Fijs there rather than Gijs, because it's the Fijs that are divergence free. Right? So if you didn't have one there, you'd have something a bit more complicated. Okay, so you get that. And now it's a test function argument. You multiply by... So we're going to get integral inequalities for integrals of Laplacian, basically. So you look at a function like this, eta squared times Laplacian to the pth power. You multiply that, this differential inequality by that, integrate by parts, and rearrange things a little bit, do some estimation, you get down to here. It's nothing mysterious there, it's just integration by parts and rearranging things a little bit. So I guess you use Cauchy-Schwarz inequality somewhere as well. And you choose a standard, completely standard cutoff function. It's 1 on B row, 0 outside 2B row, and the gradient is bounded by constant over row. And then you simply estimate the left and the right-hand sides of this. Well, on the left-hand side, you get Laplacian times p minus 1, and the minimum eigenvalue, remember, is 1 over Laplacian, so you get p minus 2. Then you've got the gradient of Laplacian squared, and you can rewrite that like this. The right-hand side you estimate using the upper bound for Fij, so that's where the fk minus 1 comes in. And you've got Laplacian to the p minus 1. So when you put all that in and estimate fk minus 1, you get Laplacian to the power p plus 2. And so when you put that all together, what you've got here is this inequality. Okay? And then you use the usual Sobolev inequality. You estimate that the left-hand side from below by an integral involving a power of Laplacian. And this is where this beta comes in, from the Sobolev inequality. So that's sort of completely straightforward, nothing difficult there. You get this inequality. And you see, if you look at this for a little while, you see that you don't always get an improvement in the exponent, because, see, if normally, if the k wasn't there, then you could just iterate this and the exponent increases no matter which p you start. But because you've got the k there, that puts a limitation on where, on when the exponent improves. Okay, so if you work it out, you see the exponent improves precisely when the right when you've got p plus k large enough. So p plus k has to be bigger than k times n over 2 is what you get. So you get that. Beta p has to be bigger than p plus k to get an improvement. And then you can, so if you start with that sort of p, you can use an iteration. So it's not quite as straightforward as the usual Mohs iteration, because it's, you've got the norm but you've got a power of the norm here. So it's a little bit more complicated, but you do get an L infinity bound for the Laplacian out of this, and it has this sort of form. You get this complicated sort of exponent here, because you're not bounding a norm by a norm, but norm by a power of a norm, a power. So you do get a bound for Laplacian, and in the setting we're in, a bound for Laplacian is equivalent to a bound for the full second derivative matrix. So that gives you the theorem for smooth solutions, provided you start with enough integrability, k n over 2. Well, the statement was that you can start with k times n minus 1 over 2. So the question is, how do you get that improvement? In other words, how do you replace n by n minus 1? The idea is, well, if you look where the n came from, it came from the Sobolev inequality. So you need to use a Sobolev inequality that's going to give you n minus 1 rather than n. And the only Sobolev inequality that's going to do that for you is a Sobolev inequality on an n minus 1 dimensional subset. Not on balls, but on the boundaries of balls. And so, how much time have I got?
3 more minutes.
Oh. Okay, well, maybe this is a good place to stop for today, and I'll explain next time how you get the better exponent. Okay, thank you.
Any questions?
In the case k equals 1, I don't have anything new to say, and it's not sharp at all. I mean, it's for k equal to 1, it's just Laplace. It's sharp at the other end. It's sharp for the Monge-Ampère equation.
Any more questions?
Let's say a couple of words. To motivate why you look at this class of differential equations. I mean, in a certain sense, you do that because you think they are universal, or they're very typical for nonlinear equations. So what motivates this?
What motivates it is it sort of provides a link between, say, the Monge-Ampère equation at one end and linear equations, Laplacian, at the other end. That's one motivation. You'd like somehow to view all these things in a more unified way, rather than sort of having sort of separate bits of theory. That's one motivation. Some of these Hessian equations have turned out in the last couple of years Not so much the Hessian equations as I've written out, but k Hessian equations where you replace the Hessian by something more complicated. They've become very interesting in geometry recently, in conformal geometry. There's a lot of work in that. So there are applications for k Hessian equations. Robert mentioned application to some geometric inequalities. So apparently the Monge-Ampère equation isn't going to do it for you there. You need to solve some sort of problem which involves a k Hessian. I think it's a 2 Hessian equation.
It's worse because they don't just involve the
eigenvalues, and they involve mixed discriminants. Yes, they're even worse. So there are applications and there are reasons for looking at this.
And in terms of the theory, so now that you have this homotopy between linear and does it give you? Do you hope that it simplifies the overall presentation of the theory?
I think it will eventually. Yes. I mean, Sometimes it takes many years before a theory achieves its sort of final form.
Okay, so we'll start at 12 minutes. Thank you again.
Yes. Thank you.
So, if instead that one is looking at the eigenvalue of the symmetric part, for instance, if I have a P Laplacian,
yes.
So instead of having the norm of rho, I have. So I call rho the. Maybe I'll write on the blackboard. Then I look at the P Laplacian. Let us call it the P Laplacian. So I look at, if I look at that, the Euler-Lagrange equation will be a P Laplacian equation, but involving a norm, which is not the Euclidean norm.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the solution, if I add this to plus infinity, the solution will satisfy this. And I wonder if I can say something about the second derivative. Or even if I can say something about, the Boolean of U, L2, because this gives just a control of the symmetric part.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I'd have to sort of look at it and think a bit about
it. So maybe I need to. I will explain a little bit.
Yeah.
More the motivation.
Yeah.
So this is a kind of vectorial version of the mass transport, the Monge-Kantorowicz problem, when you have the Euclidean distance to the power 1.
Yeah.
Instead of having that to the power p.
I think, yeah, for now, but in general.
It's basically if you have W2P and then you improve it to further.
Yeah.
And how theory goes, so as I understand, so finally you can start from basically mass and get regularity. Yes. And start from Cauchy solution and get regularity for Monge-Ampere. Or, by the way, can you do it for other equations? Or So for one purpose, for what I'm saying, is it true? So you can start from basically nothing?
No, you can't start.
Oh, you cannot? I thought this cafe was...
You got, say, zero boundary then.
Oh, and so Caparelli's things are about what? I mean, it's kind of all the geometric construction, it's quite a solution.
Yeah, when you have a Montpellier equation, you have some boundary conditions. Zero on the boundary.
So H is infinite.
You restrict on the boundary.
Yeah, one out. Yeah. The boundary condition is the same. In what you do, or in Caparelli's theory, or
in his.
Here. Oh, okay, okay. So, for example, this one. Yeah. And here you want to do it independent from boundary conditions.
Here
like
I'm doing something. I don't want to assume anything about the boundary. I just want to know where does the regularity theory start to work.
I saw a lot of kind of pieces of this, but not so many systems.
The second boundary value problem is basically the boundary condition you form a star. What I did is show that you said the Montchamp pair operates, you can replace that by a lot of other things, but as long as you have to be in a class where convexity is a natural
ellipticity.
Like Monge-Ampere equations, Gauss-Ampere equations, determinant over, say, K, that sort of thing is okay. It's an appropriate power. Look, and also place by
curvature. Yeah, of course. For that, you're proving regularity starting from trans data. Is this correct?
Yeah, in those papers, I'm proving you solve the problem, you get a global
distribution.